Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Melting Titanium Show number 101. We're here to get the party started. We're going to start a little bit early tonight. Get this rolling, rocking and rolling, and having some good, great, gobbly-gushing good times. So everybody hang on. Let's see if we can get this party started. Get you a little music going before our Bob decides to come along. So hang on, everybody. Here we go. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. Good evening, everybody. Okay, here we go.
My record. reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see.
Monster. On Boat, a government-owned alien territory in space, a birth of magnificent and magical proportions took place. But the birth was not finite, it was infinite. As the wombs numbered and the mitosis of the future began, it was perceived that this infamous moment in life is not temporal, it is eternal. And thus began the beginning of the new race, a race within the race of humanity, a race which bears no prejudice, no judgment, but boundless freedom. But on that same day, as the Eternal Mother hovered in the multiverse, another more terrifying birth took place, the birth of evil. And as she herself split into two, rotating in agony between two ultimate forces, the pendulum of choice began its dance. It seems easy, you imagine, to gravitate instantly and unwaveringly towards good. But she wondered, how can I protect something so perfect? It doesn't matter if you love him or capital H-I-M-M-M-M. Just put your paws up.
You have
one.
Whether you're broke or evergreen, your black, white, beige, so let us stand.
You're Lebanese.
these your best years, Ethel? Or is there a time in your life that you enjoyed better than now?
No, I'm just living it up, and I'm having a ball. I haven't got a care in the world, really. Life has been very, very good to me. I've had a couple of hard knocks, as you know.
A couple of jolts, right?
A couple of real jolts, yes. But you just have to rise above that, and there's somebody up there, I figure, who takes care of you.
Are they capable of writing an Ethel Merman musical now, like we've known in the past, like Call Me Madam and Annie Gets Your Gun and good Lord.
I think Julie Stein has approached me about doing a show.
Is it just too expensive now?
It costs a fortune, as you know, to put on a big musical now. I mean, like about $1 million, and some of them open and close even out of town. They don't even come into Broadway. But I know that if I would say that I would do a show, that Julie would write one for me, and I don't know whether Irving would be up to writing it. Of course, we don't have Cole or Gershwin anymore,
right,
and all the good ones have left us, you know? Yeah. Mm.
Would you go to work every night in the show?
No, I've given that up. I just adore doing what I'm doing. I did it for such a long time, and I love my freedom, and I like to do what I'm doing. I like to do the concerts. I like to come out here and do these shows, and I'm in the process now of doing a book with George Eales.
You're writing
and
that. Are we in for some surprises in your book?
A few, maybe. And then a few people might be a little bit scared. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Tell us those now.
No.
Have you had any famous feuds in your life?
Feuds? No. No, I get along pretty well with people. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
But you won't go back to work in a Broadway show?
No, I don't want to be tied down 6 nights a week.
Were there stage door Johnnies, Ethel, that we read about, or are those just column inventions?
No, I don't think so. I guess there were, but whenever I did shows, I was always sort of going with someone.
Not champagne in your shoe and bracelets at the
I hear that was like for the Ziegfeld Follies or maybe the Earl Carroll Vanity or something like that, which I never did, so I don't know. But I already did book shows. But the theater is not what it used to be, and I just don't want, as I say, be tied down 6 nights a week. I like my freedom, and Broadway has been very good to me, but I feel that I've been good to Broadway, too.
Bet you have.
And I want to just think of Ethel for a while and live a little before I say bye to the world.
Yeah, you're not going anywhere, because I'm going to stay here with you.
I hope so.
Ethel is going to sing a song that she did not do on Broadway, but she sat in an audience, and I'm sure she applauded that beautiful song from Chorus Line, What I Did for Love.
Yes.
And she's going to sing it for you now. Ethel Merman.
years ago, if you'd been at a meeting like this, and we're trying to understand the media, there was one prophet and only but one you wanted to hear from, Professor Marshall McLuhan. He actually understood something about a theme that we've been discussing all week. It's the role of the audience in an era of pervasive electronic communications. Here he is talking from the 1960s.
If the audience can become involved in the actual process of making the ad, then it's happy. It's like the old quiz shows. They were great TV because it gave the audience a role, something to do. They were horrified when they discovered they'd really been left out all the time because the shows are rigged. Now, this is a horrible misunderstanding of TV on the part of the programmers.
You know, McLuhan talked about the global village. If you substitute the word blogosphere, the internet today, it is very true that his understanding is probably very enlightening now. Let's listen to him.
The global village is a world in which you don't necessarily have harmony. You have extreme concern with everybody else's business and much involvement in everybody else's life. It's a sort of Ann Landry's column writ large. And it doesn't necessarily mean harmony and peace and quiet, but it does mean huge involvement in everybody else's affairs. And so the global village is as big as a planet and as small as the village post office.
Some of you may have been surprised as you came into this room that no whiff of brimstone came floating down from the head table. Such surprise may be understandable in view of some of the messages that the media have sent out about Mr. McLuhan. But the fact is that he is not a denier and destroyer, but an affirmer and creator, whose message, like that of many teachers before him, has been subject to diverse and contradictory interpretations, both by his supporters and his detractors. In person, if not always in print, Mr. McLuhan is, with the exception of John Kenneth Galbraith, perhaps the most relaxed controversial figure in America today. This may be due in part to their Canadian background. It's my pleasure to present the author of The Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, and the forthcoming Cliché to Archetype, Mr. Marshall McLuhan.
Before I begin to speak, I'd like to say something. I want Peg Becker to know that I simply graviate toward anything in skirts. That's for cookbooks. And also, a gal's reach has got to exceed her grasp for what's a metaphor. I'm bringing you a message from the dew line. Way up north, you built us a fine place up there. Anytime you want to come and occupy it, the whole bunch is welcome. But before I begin to speak of this, I want to say something. And let's take into account all available assumptions to begin with. The man who made two X's on his legal form was then asked by the lawyer, why two? He said, well, one is for my name and one is for my PhD. You can see what's ahead of you. There's, speaking of cooking, there was a gourmet from Virginia who went to Boston, and the first thing he said to the cabbie was, take me where I can get scrod. Now, Boston scrod is famous. But the cabbie didn't get the message, and he turned around and he said, you know, I haven't heard the pluperfect subjunctive in many years. Actually, true stories are far funnier than anything that's been concocted by a jokesmith, and this happened to me. Last year, I was coming back from Vancouver, and I landed at Kennedy Airport and was met by the narcotics division. And they said to me, do you know Tim O'Leary? And I said, I do. Well, where is it? Where's the LLD? I said, it's in my bag. Open it. They examined my LLD, and they said, you were heard on the plane to say that you had gone to Vancouver to pick up an LLD. Where is it? They didn't know the difference. You may have heard of the reporter who was sent out to get a cross-section of popular opinion on big subjects like LSD. And his first customer, or interlocutor, was asked, what do you think of LSD? Well, he said, I know some hate his guts, but I think it's the greatest president we ever had. Uh-huh. And what do you think of marijuana? Well, as for marijuana, my wife and I spent a week there last year, and it's terrific. Uh-huh. And what about the Vietnam position? Well, it's okay by me, but it gives my wife hiccups. Now, you see, way up in the land of the dew line, where we have no personality, no national identity, and no commitments and no involvement, humor reigns supreme. Humor is grievance. I heard Peg saying something about to that effect. We have many grievance jokes up there, mainly related to bilingualism and the problems of French Canada. However, there's recently a new flock of grievance jokes coming from Newfoundland because there's a new interface or irritation area in Newfoundland because the fishermen have begun to move into the cities and create irritation. You know, yokels moving into the city. And so there's great floods of Newfie jokes, like the great scientific breakthrough in Newfoundland, the first hernia transplant. It's like that the chap who overcame this problem by practicing so hard that his hernia became his strongest organ. I have a friend by the name of Professor Burgess at the University of Montreal, and he was standing at a lectern somewhat like this, incredibly complicated and useless for all human purposes. And he said he laid down his script, looked around for the lectern light, pressed a button, and the thing shot down below the stage, and he disappeared with it. Strike the set. The chairman sprang to his feet and said, our speaker needs no introduction. He's gone. It's only a few days till they invent something for the audience to match that one. The speaker will remain and you will be gone. Dr. Gross and I were having a ball during lunch talking about things like near point and speed reading and the effect they have upon the publishing industry. I suppose you all have research men working on the effects of near point resulting from television. The average reading distance of the grade 2 child at the present time is 4.6 inches from the page. The printed page which you provide for school children is useless for the TV child. The TV child is a cyclops. He only uses one eye. He's a hunter. He is not a reader. But the near-point child, all TV children read at 4.6 inches from the page, and you have not put a single researcher on this subject. Another little area that we were investigating during lunch was speed reading, which calls for total revolution in the printing presses. However, let's get back to humor. Dr. Dolbear and I we're discussing the joys of nomenclature. I received a book the other day from Mr. Harold Stammer called Speak That I May See Thee. Mr. Harold Stammer was the author. I received another book from Russell Erb called The Common Sense of Smell. It's delightful. It's full of such items as this. If you spray a lion, an African lion, with catnip, it'll die of convulsions. Which reminds me that I was a next-door neighbor of Jack Parr last year in Bronxville, and we had a lot of fun discovering why humorists hate jokes. I couldn't help telling him funny stories. The only one I got him to laugh at all year was this one. Some of my best friends are Jesuits, but wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. Now, Jack Parr is a staunch Presbyterian. He thought that was funny. Now, it's a daily threat that some Jesuit may marry your daughter. Vatican II is, I think, inferior to Vat 69 myself. But Dr. Dobier and I were talking about labels, and there is a famous book on chemical solutions. I collect these strange titles and names. By W.C. Dampier Dampier Wetham, who lives at Upwater Lodge, Cambridge, England. The world authority on chemical solutions is W.C., and you know what that is, Dampier Dampier Wetham. And Dr. Gross told me he has a cousin called Dampier Dampier Wetham Bottom. Do you know what diaper spelled backwards is? Just try it. It means repaid with interest. One of the most amusing things that ever happened to me was recently. I was at the YPO, Young President's Organization, in Puerto Rico. And I heard the scamper of little feet up the stairs behind me and a voice screaming, Marcia McLuhan, I am your fan. And she flung herself into my arms. She said, I am Ann Landers. I understand she has a twin sister who looks just like her. Well, as I said, before I say, begin to speak, I wanted to say something. I guess I've said it. But I live on a pond in Wychwood Park. Toronto, and it is number three. The house is number three. It's the only house on the pond. And so I'm going to write a cookbook called Walden 3, Peg. You have given me an idea. We will call our cookbook Walden 3, and I hope you'll provide some helpful suggestions. We heard from Mr. Salerno that crime does pay, and that does suggest that we have moved into a new epoch because I grew up in the age in which crime didn't pay. Speaking of loving thy label as thyself, did you know that the head of all American armed services and armed forces, whatever, is General Bonesteel, a civilian? You don't often hear about him, but you can find it out in the New York Times if you look up the files of last year. General Bonesteel is the head of all American armed services, and he is a civilian. I don't think this has anything to do with the mafia. But in all countries, they have jokes that are grievances, and in East Berlin today, the current one is this. Big Russian breakthrough in biology. They have crossed glowworms with body lice, and now everybody reads Pravda in bed at night. You publishers have a big grievance. I haven't heard any funny stories about it, but it's a big grievance. You don't know how to get off the hardware hook and into software. Xerox is software. Information, electric information, and you're still in the hardware business. You can get a pretty good level on this ridiculous situation by remembering that an ordinary first-class letter coming out of any office costs $4.50. More than a good paperback. And you can pretty well measure where you are in terms of hardware, software, hang up, when you realize that an ordinary one-sheet letter costs as much as a good book. Now, I don't have very much time. I thought I was going to have a full speaking engagement here, but apparently I've allowed 20 minutes. And I've got enough here for hours and hours, including an awful lot of jokes. But let me tell you a simple principle that you can all use in your business. When a fast form goes around a slow form, the slow one collapses. Any speed up in any part of your enterprises will automatically dissolve and destroy the slower parts of the enterprise. Put a fast rim spin around a slow one, and the slow one disintegrates. Put a satellite ring around the planet, and all arrangements on the planet disintegrate. It becomes garbage. Garbage means clothing. Look up Random House Dictionary, and you'll find the fifth definition of club garbage is old nose cones and capsule boosters. The new clothing of this planet is that sort of garbage. This has nothing to do with the Container Corpse of America, I mean corporation. The Container Corporation of America has provided us with a garbage environment of clothing that is colossal and staggering. But the satellites, as a new garbage or climate surround around the planet, are moving information at speeds that the planet cannot cope with and have created not a global village but a global theater. I no longer use the phrase global village. It's global theater now, and everybody out here and me too, we're all out to do our thing. Jobs are finished. Jobs are over. Role-playing comes in, hence sideburns and costumes. Nobody with a job would wear sideburns. He is playing a role. And you don't spell it R-O-L-L, it's R-O-L-E. Doing his thing. Doing your thing means involvement, whereas having a job meant simply having risen to your level of incompetence and settled down full security. The job era is finished, and incidentally, the Peter Principle belongs to 50 years ago. All humor, all funny books are automatically about past times. Past times are past times, always. Now, so when a funny book comes out, you can be sure it is nostalgic, like the Peter Principle, like Stephen Potter, one-upmanship, like Parkinson's Law. These all belong to the quaint lore of the 19th century. Now, the peculiarity of print, and I am a professor of literature full-time, I defend it right and left and center at all times. I consider it as the only origin of civilization and the only cause of civilization. And it resulted from only one alphabet in the world. There are not two alphabets. There is only one alphabet that creates civilization, and that's the phonetic alphabet. The Hebrew alphabet does not do this. The Arabic alphabet does not do this. The Chinese and Japanese letters or ideograms do not create literacy in any sense at all. Literacy consists in separating the eye from the other senses, creating Euclidean space, and creating all the illusions of rationality and uniformity and the continuum of existence. This is an illusion nourished by the Greco-Roman world only. No place in the world, no time in the world ever had this visual space except that nourished by the phonetic alphabet. Anything that undermines the phonetic alphabet and its dominance and its power of releasing the eye as the dominant organ ends civilization. There are lots of things better than civilization, but if you like civilization, that's the end of it. Civilization is a technical term based upon the dominance of the eye over the other senses. We live in an electric age which is non-visual and non-visualizable, and the chemical bond, as taught to us by Linus Pauling, Heisenberg, and others, is interval, resonance. The quantum mechanics boys have been telling us for 50 years that the bond of being, the thing that holds the world together, is sound, resonance. There are no connections in matter. Nothing that can be called a connection, only resonance. Now, one of the things that the mechanics or the quantum mechanics people and the NASA people do not know is that resonance is a peculiar kind of space. I'm simply mentioning as a simple fact that the NASA people are 18th century types, pre-Jules Verne, pre-H.G. Wells. They live in a kind of nursery world like a yellow submarine. NASA is a very old-fashioned bunch, semi-literate, never been through the real course. Anyway, the stuff they put out is cheap science fiction. It's hardware. And it's thanks to their ignorance of literacy in its full sense and ignorance of auditory space. Now, the peculiarity of auditory space, and I'm simply challenging any one of them to come forward, any scientist at all, I've met them on their own ground many times on this point. Auditory space is a very peculiar thing, and we live in echoland now. In a simultaneous, instantaneous, all-at-once electric world, that is Echoland. And that is auditory space. Auditory space has a very peculiar property. It is a perfect sphere whose center is everywhere and whose margin is nowhere. It is totally non-visual and non-visualizable. Our DNA boys and our NASA boys still try to visualize space, meaning they have no relation whatever to the science they talk about. However, I never make value judgments. I make probes. I poke away here and there and see what I can find. As I say, my own values are literary. My own values are entirely on the side of civilization. On the other hand, I don't live in that kind of a world, and so I do probe the world I live in, and it happens to be an auditory echo land. And it's full of yippies and hippies and beetles who've crawled out from under things like Kafka's bug in the Metamorphosis. One of the amazing echoes or resonances in the word beetles is Kafka's famous story, The Metamorphosis, the man who woke up in the morning and discovered he was a cockroach and tried to establish communication with his family in this unfortunate condition. Our TV generation are very much like that. They are beetles. They have crawled out from under the rug and discovered they have no means of communicating with their parents. Any of you who've seen the Yellow Submarine will know that Tiny Tim is a great, big, grown-up, mature human being compared to the world of the Yellow Submarine. The Yellow Submarine is about 4 years old, and I saw it the other night with an audience full of pot-smoking, big, long-haired guys who were accepting it as the real world, full of cops and other horrible monsters. Apropos crime, I see something coming up here. Affluence creates poverty, literally. That's why poverty is ineradicable. Crime is an attempt to establish identity, and it's only people without identities who engage in it. The nobodies. And today, the nobodies are the upper middle class of the suburbs. The new Marxian lumpen proletariat are the rich. In our world today, the activist, destructive, goalless, non-identity people are the rich. Go see the graduate, see if. It's the Etonian boys who blow up the establishment. Not the Beatles. The poor still have identities and still have goals. They still think we're running a pretty good show. But the rich have had it. They know that there are no goals left for them. And so they destroy. Violence is a quest for identity. Crime is a quest for identity. Anybody who has lost his identity will take to crime. And it isn't to make money. It's to find out, who am I? Remember the kid in the loneliness of the long-distance runner? He was asked in jail, how did he get here? He said, I couldn't run fast enough. They caught me. But in our strange world, the affluent are the activist destroyers because they've lost their identity. All the rich countries of the world, including England and most of the European countries, are in the same position of having lost their identity. Canada is the luckiest country, it's a utopia, it's the luckiest country in the world, never had an identity. We're the only people in the world who know how to live without an identity. We're nobodies. That is, you can be a French-Canadian, you can be an English-Canadian, but you cannot be a Canadian, and we do not have a flag. Now, in order to become Canadians, we would have to murder a few million of ourselves and have a nice bloodbath and then unify. That is how identity is achieved, by violence. My time is way over, and I haven't even begun my talk. So, Mr. Duffy told me he would hush me up as soon as need be. Should I shut up? All right. Let me tell you one of the peculiar things about new technologies. They wipe out the preceding technology and recover or retrieve ancient ones. The computer has revived the I Ching, the Book of Changes in China. It has revived some of the most ancient forms of medicine 4,000 years old in Japan. It has revived in your world, the coming year has been dubbed the Year of the Witch in book publishing because it is the world of the occult, of the inner trips, of numerology, and general mysticism, ESP. The world of the witch, the book of the future, the inner trip, the outer trip of civilized man is finished according to these developments. Now, the Japanese do not live in a visual world. They live in the world of what is called the Ma, M-A, meaning interval. They are the masters of electronic equipment because they understand the interval better than any human beings in the world. The interval is the world of resonance, and it is the world of jazz, the world of the hippies. When radio was new in the 1920s, the Negro, American Negro, unified for the first time since the Tower of Babel all the cultures of the world with a new form called jazz. It was a universal language and still is. We talk about integrating Negroes, and the Negroes integrated the entire blooming planet with jazz, and it still holds. And it was a language of gesture and not of words. The Beatles are in a different position. They're low-class English, and they're using some of the very oldest forms of Anglo-Saxon and some of the very oldest forms of philology as a basis for their music. One of the peculiarities of new forms, electric forms of retrieval, is that they reached back for many centuries to grab things that man had forgotten long ago. In all of this, you can see yourselves in a very peculiar position. The United States is the only country in the world founded on literacy. All other countries had been going for centuries before Gutenberg. The United States is the only country in the world that began with the latest technology, Gutenberg technology. It is therefore having the hardest time of any country in the world in orienting itself in the electric age. The Negro can do it, but the WASP can't. Radio brought in the new criticism, depth criticism, penetrating the auditory resonance of words, ignoring the semantics in the dictionaries, going for the resonance, what Eliot called the auditory imagination, retrieving the most ancient primal memories of the race by resonance. Now you can see that dictionaries drive words out of their senses by pinning them down to non-resonant and very visual definitions. As early as 1830, Lamartine, the poet, said, "The book arrives too late. He should be around now." The thing that amazes me is how long it takes to get a book into print. The Gutenberg Galaxy was proofread from cover to cover in one afternoon by a group of my students. And with the same team, we could have had that book printed in 24 hours. Out on the stands. The Gutenberg Galaxy has a very large number of long quotations, all of which were exactly and accurately proofread in one afternoon. You're not going to get very far without a lot of teamwork, but Lamartine in 1830 was thinking of the newspaper when he said, "The book arrives too late." He was not thinking of the telegraph, it hadn't arrived. With the telegraph came a total change in the forms of writing, symbolism. Symbolism simply means pulling out the connections between parts of sentences. I write symbolism. I don't finish I think of my sentences as telegrams to Australia, 50 cents a word. You know, if every author had to inscribe every one of his words on stone and were allowed 12 words a year, the levels of writing would go up, up, up. But one of the things, one of the peculiarities and unexpected results of speed up of electricity, telegraph, and so on, one of the strange effects on writing was an understanding for the first time of the creative process. From Poe and Baudelaire, Mallarmé, and onward to Joyce and Eliot, the understanding of the creative process has mounted and mounted, and we understand now that it is very closely related to sensory perception. Let me reassure you people, I once spoke in 1957, in June, to the radio car broadcasters, and at that time they were terrified of the coming effects of television. And I said, in June 1957, I said, the medium is the message, you've nothing to fear. I can say that to you. The book is a very special form of communication. It is unique, and it will persist. I would suggest that one of the main reasons for its persistence in the future will be scriptural study. From the 3rd century A.D. till the Renaissance, the reason the book survived was scripture. With Gutenberg, the press reached out and grabbed antiquity for the first time. The Middle Ages had no way of printing ancient books. Gutenberg reached out and grabbed Greece and Rome and dumped it into the Renaissance lap as a huge pile of garbage. And it kept creative minds very busy dealing with garbage for a long time. Artists love garbage and slums. They hate suburbs and tidiness. No involvement. So the future of creativity is colossal in the world of garbage. Creativity will be king from now on as we create successively new and massive planetary scopes of garbage. I haven't even asked myself very much about the effects of laser on printing, the laser beam and channel 87. On the cable TV, which can print books and dump them into your living room very fast. The three P's, Peter, Potter, and Parkinson, seem to be taking over from the three R's. But I'm going to skip on and conclude very quick. This afternoon, Jackie Susan's book, The Love Machine, is to be presented to you, and that's fairly soon. I wrote a book in 50, actually about 1940, called The Mechanical Bride, and I now can see very clearly that I was a little behind. With the coming of the electric age, the machine age finishes. The mechanical forms of love are finished. We live in a new and very organic and involved age, and the love machine is a thing of the past. The machine world is a thing of the past. That doesn't mean that it's going to disappear. It means that it's going to be carefully preserved in the Smithsonian and in other precious museums. But you can see from the miniskirt, which is that the end is in sight. The miniskirt is a costume worn by all tribal people, men and women alike. The miniskirt means the end of sex. Unisex has come. Until 1710, the word sex was never used once to mean allure. It was used to mean gender. We're back at that stage. Sex as allure has ended. Sex is now a technical term meaning male or female. Thanks to overdoing it, I wrote this in Playboy some months ago. the reversal of the overheated medium. When we step up sex a bit, why, it ceases to be sex. It just becomes what it is for all tribal people, a mild and very, well, like coffee to us, very casual. Sex as an exciting, enthralling, alluring thing is finished, and the miniskirt is shouting that out very loud. I was coming home from Denmark the other day, and on the plane beside me was George Ball. He told this story. He said he was talking with George Jessop and Dean Acheson, and Acheson was complaining about his sleeplessness, and Jessop pulled some things out of his pocket and said, "Dean, try these." And Dean took them, and about 2 a.m., Jessop had a screaming phone call to the effect, "I can't swallow them." And Jessop said, "Man, those are earplugs." Apropos of the population explosion, just another funny statistic. The entire population of this world at this minute can stand on the Isle of Wight, a tiny little island off the south coast of England. If you press close together, all of us could stand, the whole planet, on that little island. Since the invention of elastic, the space occupied by women has been reduced by one-third. We can now all sit down on the Isle of Wight. Now, let me end on a cheerful note. The amount of booze consumed annually in this country cost $24,000 million. $24 billion. That doesn't sound as good. $24,000 million. Staggering figure. You can see some of them. Now, only a very literate country can absorb that much booze. I assure you that a non-literate country like the Arab world or any other non-literate world will find, like our Indians, a very little booze is a very explosive firewater mix. So as long as our liquor bill stays high, you're safe. You've got it made as masters of the print world. Now, UNESCO is planning radios for all the people in the world as a way of extending enlightenment. And when you put a radio in a pre-literate
everywhere. He is anybody. He knows everything. This is the Prometheus New World. It all started with the media revolution, with the internet, at the end of the last century. Everything related to the old media vanished. Gutenberg, copyright, the radio, television, advertisement. The old world reacts. More restrictions for copyright. New laws against unauthorized copies. Napster, the music peer-to-peer company, is sued. At the same time, free internet radio appears. TiVo, the internet television, allows the viewer to avoid commercials. The Wall Street Journal goes online. Google launches Google News. Every day, millions of people read All My News, the biggest online newspaper written by thousands of journalists. Flickr becomes the biggest repository in the history of photos, YouTube for movies. The power of the masses. A new figure emerges, the prosumer, a producer and a consumer of information. Anyone can be a prosumer. The news channels become available on the internet. Blogs become more influential than the old media. Newspapers are released for free. Wikipedia is the most complete encyclopedia ever. In 2007, Life magazine closes. The the New York Times sells its television and declares that the future is digital. BBC follows. In the main cities of the world, people are connected for free. At the corners of the streets, totems print pages from blogs and digital magazines. Millions of people are now getting used to the internet, many virtual worlds. A person can have multiple online identities. Second Life launches the vocal avatar. The old media fight back. A text is added on any screen. Newspapers, radios, and televisions are financed by the state. Illegal downloading from the web is punished with years of jail. Around 2011, the tipping point is reached. Advertisement investments are done on the net. The electronic paper is a mass product. Anyone can read anything on plastic paper. In 2015, newspapers and broadcasting television disappear. Digital terrestrial is abandoned. The radio goes on the internet. The media arena is less and less populated. Only the Tyrannosaurus Rex survives. The net includes and unifies all the content. Google buys Microsoft. Amazon buys Yahoo, thus becoming the world universal content leaders with BBC, CNN, and CCTV. The concept of static information, books, articles, images, changes and is transformed into knowledge flow. Advertisement is chosen by the content creators, by the authors themselves, and becomes information, comparison, experience. In 2020, Lawrence Lessig, the author of Free Culture, is the new U.S. Secretary of Justice and declares copyright illegal. Devices that replicate the five senses are available in the virtual worlds. Reality could be replicated in Second Life. Anyone has an AGAV, Agent Avatar, that finds information, people, places in the virtual worlds. In 2022, Google launches Prometheus, the AGAV standard interface. Amazon creates Place, a company that replicates reality. You can be on Mars, at the Battle of Waterloo, at the Super Bowl as a person. It's real. In 2027, Second Life evolves in the spirit. People become who they want and share the memory, the experiences, the feelings. Memory selling becomes normal trading. In 2050, Prometheus buys Place and Spirit. Virtual life is the biggest market on the planet. Prometheus finances all the space missions to find new worlds for its customers. The terrestrial avatar. Experience is the new reality.
Okay, so what does it extend?
The opportunity to connect.
Yeah.
We are in the age of Homo contextus, which is very close to my Homo connectus, and so it always means that we are getting very close to being able to exchange and find like-minded people with much greater ease and speed than was ever possible before. And so that's a big jump. So let's leave it at that.
Yeah. So what does it make obsolete? What does it amputate? What does it remove?
It makes obsolete the top-down, straight mass media communication. It makes it crumble on itself because it shows all of its weakness, because the moment that you can see next to traditional top-down one-way communication, the fact that people can talk back, can have a conversation with the companies through other media, all of that facade of marketing yourself with some glamorous slogans that don't reflect who you are, in fact, are slowly all crumbling down. So that's what it amputates.
Really? So, well, what new opportunities it creates then? So what is...
It creates opportunity for everyone to be a media person, for everyone to become part of this planetary conversation, planetary research, planetary desire to be not just a number anymore, not to be dependent exclusively on authorities that dictate what and when you have to do whatever you do, first in school, then in work, then for your nation. You can now participate, have more opportunities to do the things you like or write about them or contact people that are interested in those, associate with them, meet them, try to change things. It's become something more tangible.
Yeah, so...
Hello, I'm Edwin Newman. Speaking freely today is Marshall McLuhan. I'm sure it's not necessary to offer any clues to who Marshall McLuhan is. If there's anybody who does not recognize the name, it should be sufficient to say the medium is the message. However, it might be useful to sketch in a little background. Marshall McLuhan is a Canadian. He's a professor of English at the University of Toronto. He is director at that university of the Center for Culture and Technology. His writings, some of which were done in collaboration with others, include The Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, The Mechanical Bride, The Medium is the Massage, and most recently, From Cliché to Archetype. Mr. McLuhan, this question is inevitable, I guess. You're probably sick of it. Why is the medium the message? Why is not the message the message? Where would you look for the message in an electric light? Is there necessarily a message in an electric?
Well, there certainly is. Or a candle. The medium and the message are the same. When you think of the medium as a container, you are thinking in visual terms the hidden meaning of a container is the visual habit of man to put something in its place or around something. The visual man has very much an inclination to make things contain things. But visual space has very peculiar properties. Static. Most people think of space as static. As, for example, the space between you and me, as something that is constant. That is, between you and me, there are so many inches or so many measures, and that those are the same no matter who's sitting there. To a preliterate man, space has no static properties at all. They're entirely determined by the people or things that are involved in the spatial relationship. So that a person is thought of as creating his own kind of space and not as being inside space. The preliterate man, the man who lives more by ear than by eye, does not think of himself as being in space at all. There's a delightful little illustration of how preliterate people, children, feel space. A child on his first airplane flight said, as they took off and climbed higher and higher, he said, "Daddy, when do we start to get smaller?" Now, this is a true and happening, and it has the immediate feeling of the natural, authentic child observation about space. To an adult, it seems perfectly obvious that the static space in which people are contained would remain the same, and that people in that space would remain the same. In point of fact, this is an illusion on the part of the adult. The child is much more in tune with the reality than the adult in this matter. The child is replying to or responding to a dynamic space created by changing physical relationships.
If the physical relationship, Professor McLuhan, does not change, as between us, for example, does the space change?
There's an entire study of this sort of thing by Edward Hall. It's called The Silent Language. It's a study of the kinds of spaces that people use between one another in their daily lives. And he points out how in various parts of the world these spaces vary enormously. And one of the more striking illustrations is the Arab space, preferably 8 inches between people who are friendly, because they like to smell each other.
This is Arab?
Arab.
Arab space.
Now, the visual man prefers the sort of space that there is between you and me. They like to look at each other. They don't think of a friendly relationship as primarily based upon the sense of smell.
As a matter of fact, that's discouraged in our
yes,
society.
Yes, a visual society is very hostile to odors, except as means of disguising physical facts. And this, the more literate the society, the more narrow the sensory area of awareness, the more specialist, the more concentrated on visual factors. A friend of mine was recently on an expedition with some Indians. He has as a job the finding of the proper names, native names, for various places and lakes and rivers in Canada. And on their coming home one evening, they got off trail, and after a while he said to one of the Indians, "We're lost." And the Indian looked quite startled, and he said, "We're not lost. Wigwam is lost." The idea, you see, to an Indian, the idea that a human being getting lost is meaningless, because the man makes his own space. Now, the wigwam could get lost because it is not that dynamic factor that the human being is. This Ed Hall's books on the study of spaces between people, personal spaces, are quite startling in their way of revealing our very peculiar assumptions.
Well, to take this one step further, you have written, "It is no longer possible to take a fixed position for more than a single moment." Is that meant literally? Do you mean anything literally? Perhaps I should put that question.
You can see that a point of view literally means a static position with a vanishing point. Now, in practice, there is no such position, and perhaps there never was. A person sighting a target with a very high precision instrument, there might be a point of view on a particular object, a target. This idea of a fixed position from which to see things in perspective is a very recent origin in the Western world. And in Shakespeare's time, it was a completely new and exciting experience. It is a kind of outlook that ran into all sorts of difficulties with the scientists in the 17th and 18th centuries, with Newton and others, and Berkeley or Berkeley. The relative position of the visual with regard to the other senses in locating or fixing people's experience in space became a great controversial matter. Newton was quite Swift, rather, was quite amused at Newton's ideas of space and, in effect, said Newton did not discover gravity but levity. What everyone knew about gravity, what Newton discovered was up-pull, not down-pull. And so Swift turned Newton's world into a joke with the flying island of Laputa. The great scientific utopia of Laputa is airborne, or it's weightless. It's strange that our scientists have given up on weightlessness as a means of solving transportation problems. They've gone for the moon, but they've not thought of anti-gravitation. As a way of getting there.
Why do you say they've given up on it, since they do take account of it in space travel?
In what way would you say they take account of weightlessness?
Within the capsule. I mean, it does exist within the capsule.
I've often asked myself, when you are weightless, as in a capsule in a space, would you see things upside down? As you know, the normal human mode of perception is at all times upside down. Why do we turn them right side up? Nobody knows. No psychologist even has a theory about why do we see upside down and turn things right side up. Now, if there's any gravitational cause for this flipping the image, then it would be possible or imaginable that in a weightless state, we would see upside down and keep it upside down. But the Stratton glasses were invented to enable us to, when put on, they turn the world upside down again. It takes a while to having put them on and seeing the world upside down again. It takes a while before you turn it right side up. It takes several hours. Then if you take the glasses off, the world goes upside down again and stays that way for several hours. Nobody knows why people do this. And it's very strange. And I've often wondered whether weightlessness would in any way affect this. Now, in the Eskimo world, for example, there is no upside down. You know, small children don't see pictures right side up or upside down. It doesn't matter which way you hold it to a small child, say a 2 or 3 year old. It's the same. It's only later that this habit of right side upness begins. Now, why? I don't know, and nobody knows. But in the Eskimo world, there is no attempt made to turn pictures right side up. They stick them on their igloos and so on in any position at all. And they're always amazed when visitors come and start craning their necks around to see these pictures. They think it's very amusing because they don't see any other, they don't have any upside down. When they're drawing a picture, they're just as happy drawing underneath the table. When they come to the edge of a table, they go under and draw up without seeing as freely as mm-hmm. when they see. They don't need eyes in order to draw. And they don't think of drawing as for the eyes. But this habit of sensory orientation by which we think of space as a fixed container has had an enormous effect upon our ideas of a medium as containing a program.
Before you go ahead on that, may I just ask you, by the way, if the Eskimos do not consider drawings to be, or drawing to be for the eye, what do they consider it?
Oh, tactility has great priority over sight in their world.
Is it more nearly a form of sculpture, then, as
yeah.
drawing?
And as you know, in contemporary poetry and art, the priority of the sculptural or the tactile has replaced the visual order. The scandal of the cubism or the scandal of much symbolist art was the scrapping of visual space, the throwing aside of the visual in favor of the audile tactile. Of course, at the same time, quantum mechanics was discovering that the physical or chemical bond was resonance, that there is no connection in matter. That is perhaps another way of coming to this medium and the message thing. In visual space, we think of things as continuous and connected. Eh? There is no connection in auditory space or tactile space to the sense of touch. There are no connections. There are only resonances, beats, rhythms, closures. And to smell, to all the other senses, kinetic movement and so on, there is no continuity, no connection, only discontinuity. And this idea of the visual man, the Euclidean man, that space is continuous and uniform and connected, does not apply in the electronic age to any of the senses except sight. And under electronic conditions, even the visual has lost that continuous character. Under especially television conditions, it becomes once more a mosaic, a collage of resonant dots, spots.
Are you, Professor McLuhan, seeking to approximate that in any way when in your book or your books you have the chapters readable in any sequence? So they don't have to be read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on?
That, in this particular book, The Ecclesiate Archetype, was the result of having simply created a file of chapters alphabetically and having noticed that they had a kind of dynamic pattern or logic from the absurd to theater. The first chapter was absurd and the last chapter was theater. And it seemed that the intervening order was also a dynamic one. This is the way the book had grown. And so we just hit upon the idea of retaining it as a pattern of growth. This, the idea of pattern recognition, one of the peculiar new awarenesses of our time, is the result of speed up. When things move very quickly, their pattern of form of them appears very plainly. Whereas when things move very slowly, it's not so easy to see a pattern. This has something to do with a lot of the confusions of our world. When people who had previously been quite content in a fixed position in a job or a career are suddenly confronted with very fast-moving situations where they can see overall patterns, they suddenly become very discontented with their place, their fixed position. So the dropout is a normal a kind of response to pattern recognition.
This is the global village that you...
No, but I mean, in all aspects of our society, the people who are dropping out right, left, and center are people who suddenly have seen a pattern in their lives. Instead of just a fixed position, visually oriented, everything in its place, a place for everything, a classification, a job, people suddenly want to be involved in more dynamic patterns. For example, a talk show is an example of this new need or demand for involvement in dynamic situations in which two people begin to inquire of each other in such a way that both of them can make discoveries about the other.
Is there a need on the part of the viewer for that?
The viewer can participate more fully in such a dialogue than he can in just listening to a packaged delivery. Packaged material, whether it's in the advertising world or in the educational world, is no longer acceptable. The consumer status has been greatly downgraded. We live in a world in which the consumer habits have been yielding steadily to producer involvement. And so the TV audience acts now as a producer. Had you ever thought of the instant replay in football as creating a totally new form of audience participation in the dynamics of a game?
Well, I don't quite see how the instant replay enters into the dynamics of the game.
Well, it very much concerns cliché to archetype. That's why I circled
yes.
around to it.
Yes, I've noticed that you say that. In fact, I think I've outlined
it. Yes, well, it isn't really an outline of the book. It's an outline of these themes as they appear in many situations outside. But In an instant replay, the in effect, you say, let us stop this action. Halt it. Arrest. Hold it. Then you say, now, what has just happened in this game had this effect. Let us see how we achieved this effect. Let us replay that action and observe how this particular effect was obtained. Now, this is the attitude of every artist to every artistic production. He says, in effect, hold that action. I want to capture it in another medium.
But are not the dynamics, let us say, of a football game, which is most of what you're talking about, confined to the field on which the game is being played?
Well, in the case of football, you have an audience without which... there would be no game. What would a game, a football game, be without an audience? It would be a practice. Many of the best games ever played in America have been played in empty stadia as practice games between great teams. But because there's no public, there's no game. Now, today, the name of the game has become a sort of...
There's a game, but there's no spectacle, perhaps.
No, there's no game at all without a public. Without the audience, there is no game. In a theater, if there's no audience at all, you have a rehearsal, but you don't have a play. Now, in the case of a playback, you are in the presence of the artistic process. An artist always says, how could I get that effect? I must go back and replay it. So what has happened to football since the replay is that the public now demands that the game be changed so that they can see the process by which the effects are attained. The games are even halted until the replays are completed on TV. It isn't just halted for the ads, but for the replays.
Now, I must say, Professor McLuhan, I have the impression that the replays were played on television while the team with the ball was going into the huddle.
But they sometimes have to wait until the replay is completed. The public sometimes bring their own sets to watch the replays during the game.
I hadn't known that. They take these sets into the stadium, do they?
And they use the sets in the stadium, in the lobbies and so on, eagerly during the game, too. Now, this is a new form of participation in the game as process. Now, in our time, the public has demanded access to the artistic process in every field, including the schoolroom. The learning process is now something in which children expect to participate, not just as consumers, but as producers. And they get this from TV.
This is because of the speed up in communications, is it?
Yes, and because TV is in a par excellence way a medium of processes. It reveals processes as never before, not just products. So that you only have to watch the more effective forms of advertising to see that the ad is never presented as a product, but always as a process of participation. This is where Sesame Street has shone, made by Madison Avenue experts. It shows the entire learning process in action and in the best advertising style. But the need for participation in process, as I suggest, is very much indicated in the popularity of talk shows, where dialogue or Johnsonian probing and digging of assumptions and patterns and so on is back in popular demand. Whereas the lecture and any form of potted packaged stuff is dead.
Is dead on television.
Dead anywhere. It isn't acceptable in the classroom anymore.
But it is certainly acceptable to take a small point outside the classroom. The lecture circuit in the United States, for example, is enormous, isn't it? You could lecture six times a day, I imagine, if you wanted to.
I am not sure. I'm just not sure. You may be quite right that there is an enormous popularity of lectures at the moment. I think this may have something to do with people, though, going into circuit who are well-known in some other medium.
Yes, yes, that's perfectly true.
But they're here now. Here again is where the medium is the message. In any case of a medium, the so-called content is always another medium. In movies, the content is not a movie. It's a book, a play, a vaudeville act. It is some sort of turn from another medium. In vaudeville, the content is always from some other area of the community. No medium ever uses itself as content, except the electric light. That's why I mentioned that earlier. A light is an example in which the content and the medium are the same thing. There's only one. There are not two. But to come back, though, notice that in TV you have movies, and movies have, since TV, become art forms. They've been upgraded from popular entertainment into art. And this is one of the peculiarities of media. And they take any old cliché and they rub it against another cliché and they upgrade it into archetype. The process by which the banal, the most trite and obvious everyday thing, is transformed into something artistic is by rubbing against another cliché.
Could you give an example of that? I had to warn you that the questions would be somewhat literal.
Yes, we were playing with the example, an example a few minutes ago when I used the phrase, say, of Ring Lardner, "Shut up," he explained.
As I perhaps should just explain that you used that before we started the program.
The expression "shut up," he explained, is a clash of two cliches, "shut up" and "as he explained." Both are banal and ordinary gestures, as we use in such expressions as "well, anyway," "now," or "anyhow." These gestures of endlessly repeated kind gradually accumulate a huge charge of human experience from many, many situations. When they are rubbed against another cliché, they flash out all this energy that's in them. Now, James Joyce made a whole book of these epiphanies and flashing forth of form called Finnegan's Wake. And the title itself is one of these rubbings of clichés together, Finn, the Finn cycle, the Finnegan, and Finnegan, Michael Finnegan. The old song about he had whiskers on his chin again, long came the wind and blew them in again, poor Michael Finnegan, begin again. Now, the Finn cycle is a perpetual, repetitive cycle of tribal culture, which interested Joyce very much. But the Finn, when played again and again, revealed a consciousness that was wake. Awake. So by rubbing the Finn again against Finn and rubbing the tribal cycle against itself, Joyce got awake out of what had been a tribal sleep. And his theme was that our modern world is going back into the Finn cycle, but wide awake. The world of Jung and Freud is the world of the unconscious. Now, in tribal society, there is no unconscious. It's only the visual man, the highly literate man, who carefully stuffs things into his unconscious. The tribal man has everything up in his consciousness.
This is the result of print, the result of the alphabet and the result of print.
Well, but I'm saying that tribal man, long before printing or any form of writing, tribal man lives corporately, not privately, in a world of consciousness that includes everything we call subconscious. Now, in the electric age, the private man has been scrapped. Corporate man is back. Again, I'm not talking about ideals. It's simply that at high speeds, the private outlook of the private individual with his personal point of view, is scrapped by virtue of the speed up of electric information which goes totally around him. As Electric Man goes inside this resonating envelope of information, he joins this subconscious world that had previously been created by ages of private consciousness, and the gap between the private and the collective consciousness ends. It's like the gap in the world of the satellite. The rim spin of the satellite around the planet has ended nature by putting the planet inside as the content of a medium of satellites. Now, when you... put the Earth inside a man-made environment, the Earth becomes an arc form, and nature is over. Ecology is born. The idea of a totally programmed planet takes the place of just a haphazard nature.
I wanted to ask you about this. It's one of the questions I had written down. You have, I'm flattered to say, anticipated many of them. But the word ecology is an ancient word.
Yeah, and ecology has many meanings in our world, and including ECHO, echo. It's a world of resonance in which everything happens at once. Everything bangs against everything. An ecological world is a world of echo land. It's a world of simultaneous resonance in which people instinctively feel that everything affects everything.
But the original meaning of ecology and the origin, its Greek origin...
is not very clear, is it? The ekos is not a very simple etymology. If you've had a dig into the etymology of ecology, you'll find that it's not by any means plain. And it's a nice echo word, and it's a nice resonant pun word. It's takes you into a space where there can be more than one meaning simultaneously and contradictory meanings. When you move into a world of contradictory simultaneous meanings, you're in the world of puns.
Of which you're very fond of.
Well, puns are simply ways of seeing more than one side, or hearing or taking more than one side of a thing at a jump. The old, it used to be done in terms of the Irish bull. You never hear anymore about the Irish bull. But the Irish bull was defined once, I think, this way. When you see three cows standing in a pasture, the one that's sitting is the Irish bull. Now, this is a way of trying to say simultaneously that the Irishman is not a rational, logical person in our way. That he knows very well that the Irish bull is lazy. And he does not intend to be dictated to by women. And so, the Irish bull is, if there are three cows in a pasture, the Irish bull is the one that is sitting. This is a very irrational statement, but it captures instantly this peculiar quality in an illogical world. A turtle-like cliché to archetype is simply a way of drawing attention to the fact that simultaneously, the most profound things and the most superficial things are the same. And when you scrap nature, you retrieve the most ancient forms of cliché from the world of the unconscious and the world of the occult.
Because the word cliché in our own time has come to have a rather invidious meaning.
Literary.
And you don't use it.
It's a literary meaning.
Yes, but you don't use it in that sense.
No, I use it in the sense of any repetitive activity, and it can be... yeah, on an assembly line, or it can be... The word comes from stamping paper forms with an impress. And it is itself a term from printing.
That's in French. It's taking a photograph.
And imprinting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the photographic light act. But this fact that a a new environment such as radio, any new service environment, is a cliche. It isn't verbal. But when printing was new, it created a total new environment of services that became a cliche.
Now, you have written, Professor McLuhan, that printing created nationalism and it created
yes.
individualism. How did it do that?
Print, for example, created what we call the reading public. There was no reading public in the Middle Ages, in the age of the manuscript. There were many kinds of publics. Today, at very high speeds of information, there is no longer a reading public. There are multitudes of reading publics, multitudes of listening publics, viewing publics, many, many kinds of publics. There used to be, in the 19th century, a much more unified public. In the 18th century, very much so, too. But since the electric age, we have decentralized, and nationalism is collapsing on all fronts in our time into tribalism or into all sorts of little small cultures. Well, with the coming of print, it became possible for the first time for people speaking a single language to have a common political form based upon the written word. And nobody expected this. Nobody dreamt that there could be such a thing as a national unity coming out of a uniform printing press in which their own language was translated into this visual medium.
What then is the future of print? What will happen to it?
Well, as you can see right now, that printing takes many forms, unexpected new forms, including color. Printing, I should think, is in a more revolutionary state today of innovation and development than it has ever been. And we speak of prints, voice prints. With printing has now extended its area of efficacy to many, many fields of the photographic and to the video world and to various forms of recording and so on, which are still prints. Printing has become an enormously diversified area, whereas formerly it had been relatively limited. And going with each new technology is a new public. Now, we're not prepared for this, and it means that national unity breaks down very rapidly under these fast-moving conditions. And so all sorts of dissident groups pop up where formerly there'd been a relative homogeneity. Now, this is not necessarily good, and I think it may well be that people will anticipate many of the consequences of innovation in the future and say no.
As in the case of the SST, perhaps.
Possibly. I think that we are moving rapidly toward a time when people will inquire about what will be the consequences of this innovation as it hits into this and that field. And people will say, well, it would be revolutionary and astounding, but I don't think we're able to take it. I don't think that we can absorb that variety of shocks and that variety of changes in a very short time. Most people take a long while to adjust to quite simple changes. And when invited to readjust their entire lives every few years to very vast changes, people tend to fall apart. The loss of private identity under electric conditions has created dropoutism on a fantastic scale.
May I ask you a point on that? You have written or spoken of electric circuitry as the first new tool in 1,000 years. Am I quoting you correctly?
I don't recall exactly where that might have been said. I think it's probably defensible as a position. Although this electric circuit has created a vast number of new tools related to many other fields. That is, without the electric circuit, we wouldn't have dentistry as we know it. And when you think of the number of services related to that circuit, it doesn't limit the circuit to being a single or simple sort of tool. The circuit as an instrument, a technology, is in a very ambiguous state in scientific quarters. Most people think of a circuit as something that moves, but the scientists are by no means sure of what moves, if anything, in electric circuits. There may be fields that form here and there in the circuit. There may be new patterns and postures of particles, but whether anything actually moves, I think, is in great doubt. This is another example of the visual man thinking of connected movement as inevitable. Our scientists are still inclined to make visual models of light particles and particles that move at the speed of light, for which no visualization is possible. But this is the bias of a highly visual culture. I think our youngsters today, they're coming up through the rock and roll division, are totally devoid of any need to visualize.
I know you're... Not in the habit of making what are called value judgments. You merely try to explore, as you said. But you hinted a moment ago that perhaps all innovation wasn't good and could be resisted.
I myself am rather impressed by the limits of human beings and their powers to cope with innovation. And I really think you'll find, if you look back in human history, that most innovations were killed off at once, at birth.
It is possible successfully to resist innovation, is it?
It's very strange to... I have encountered over and over again the assumption in my readers that anything I describe I must approve of. If it is there and if it is happening, it must be good. Otherwise, they wouldn't know how to value it. Is this an evolutionary idea of progress, that any change is part of evolution and must be progress? I wonder. I'm really baffled. I don't pretend to know the answers, but I've been called, for example, I make my living, as it were, and my whole vocation out of the book. I've been called the enemy of the book because in the Gutenberg Galaxy, I describe how the book is being changed and modified by electric technology, perhaps superseded. I don't consider this a desirable thing, but the mere fact that it's happening seems to occur to many people as value judgment. I'm baffled. Perhaps some of your audience will offer some explanations of why people would tend to assume that anything that happens in the way of innovation or development must be to our advantage.
Is there some kind of religious belief implicit in that?
I don't know, although Lynn White, strangely enough, in his book Machina Ex Deo, the idea of technology as born of God himself, argues, and as far as I know, he's the only person who does, that it is Christianity alone that has made technology possible in our Western sense, that only a very optimistic view of man and his development would have permitted the kinds of extreme innovation that we have developed in, say, the past 1,000 years. That his view is that medieval technology, which is the beginning of modern science and so on, could only have been possible under the extreme optimism of Christianity, that all pagan cultures would have frowned upon it very early.
This has something to do with the belief in the perfectibility of human nature, I suppose.
Partly perfectibility, also the idea that man deserves to be relieved from all the burdens possible by his own powers. Any of his powers are good. Anything he can do with his own powers to make life more livable is good. This is not a doctrine acceptable in other cultures, which take a much dimmer view of human activity. And the pagans, the ancient Greeks and Romans, wouldn't have for a moment entertained this idea.
I'm very interested, Professor McLuhan, to hear you say that innovation is resistible, because most of us, as far as our educations have gone, are given the example of the smashing of machines and mills and that kind of thing, which didn't stand in the way of the Industrial Revolution, for example. And you referred to the SST. One of the arguments put forward for it, I'm not going to ask you about the SST, is that it is going to be built. There is a built-in assumption that the SST will
be
built.
If it can be built, it ought to be built. This is the strange equation.
Yes.
If something can be done, it ought to be done. This is a very weird... I think perhaps this is where the atom bomb brought people into a paradox. It could be done, and suddenly it seemed very undesirable. Wasn't it Einstein's feeling that he would have been better to have spent his life as a plumber? I think he said somewhere in his autobiography that if I had my life to live again, I'd be a plumber. It seemed it was as if he was reflecting upon the misfortune of having discovered how to split the atom. But yes, I think in the ecological age, we are going to ruthlessly prune out innovation if it threatens the balance of human powers and cultural interchange.
We're now living in the electric age, are we? But most of us don't realize it. Is that correct?
The age of instant information as a total surround, as a new cliche. You see, fish, it's not my invention, but someone said, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. People never are aware of the things that are totally surround them, and hence the cliches of technological environment are invisible. The emperor's new clothes are always invisible. Except to little children, or kibitzers of that type who are outside the game, who will come in from outside the culture and are not prepared to accept its assumptions, perceptually or otherwise. So today, there isn't any game at all that doesn't have kibitzers coming in from outside the game, from other cultures. And so this is perhaps one of the causes of our self-awareness. When you have a surround of instant information, which is electric information, you have a situation surely unknown to human beings in any previous age. It means the end, for example, of subjects. When you have instant access to all information simultaneously, you can't have subjects. Children know this instinctively in the schools. You can't have jobs. You can only have roles. A job is a specialist activity with a fixed boundary. And in a resonant, simultaneous world of auditory space, you cannot retain these fixed boundaries. So jobs are out. People prefer role-playing. There is, by the way, since there's a movie coming along called Cromwell, it may have some bearing. Cromwell, in relation to Charles I, represented the application of the new print technology to military affairs, his Ironsides. And he had no trouble scrapping the old royalty, but he was unprepared for the retrieval. It's one thing to scrap, turn into camp or old hat, some recent thing, but usually when you scrap something recent like that, as print did when it scrapped the scribe and the scholastic philosopher, there's always another kick or flip, a retrieval, a sudden return of something long forgotten. It happened with us electrically with the coming back of horoscopes, ESP, and the occult. In the age of Cromwell, what came back with the destruction of monarchy was the saint. The royal martyr was transformed into a saint. And the highly religious society of Cromwell's time, Puritan society, was not prepared to entertain a royal martyr, a sudden retrieval from primitive Christianity.
Well, could that have been avoided if the king's head had not been cut off? Was that a practical matter?
I don't know. I've never heard the matter raised before. But, you know, Hamlet was somewhat in this position. One of the reasons why Hamlet, Fortinbras, the strong man, comes marching on the stage. Poor Hamlet. He was an ideal prince, but medieval style. Loyal, devoted, and fun-loving, an actor, loving the profession of acting and the games of acting, but utterly unprepared for the serious, grim business that Fortinbras and his efficiency experts were bringing onto the scene. Hamlet was suddenly out of a job with the print. Not Wittenberg, but Gutenberg finished off Hamlet. He was scrapped and thrown on the junk heap by Fortinbras, the Cromwell of his time. The idea of marching in even rows was a startling innovation at that time, an irresistible thing. It, even in Napoleon's time, it was considered a radical. To drill men on the field in rigid rows in marching in uniform patterns. Napoleon laid planks, I've been told, on the field so that his yokels could march in straight lines, because it's not natural to march in straight lines in sequence. And he tied the legs of his men together 18 inches apart so they could march uniformly. This turning a group of men into a machine, an irresistible, uniform, repetitive machine. This is what Cromwell discovered. And the turning of society into a great machine of repeatable, replaceable parts was the Gutenberg thing as it was extended to the military and so on.
But that is going now.
It is going. And in place of that, you have the guerrilla.
Mm-hmm. Helped along enormously.
The guerrilla fighter, he may invade this studio at any moment to report or resist some outrageous thing said on this program. It's happened recently, as you know, in some of the talk shows.
Well, he can't do it here because we're cleverly evading that by taping this in advance. But I suppose the principle is the same. I suppose what is different in our time in particular is the idea of the urban guerrilla, isn't it?
Yeah. We've had some strange examples of it up in Canada. But the sudden discovery of anonymity within the city. And in Quebec, the captors of Mr. Cross lived in the same house with the police on another floor and remained totally invisible for 6 weeks.
Should this not, under the theories you've been sending out, disappear as we begin to lead this more corporate life that you've talked about? Should not the anonymity be cut off? Should they not disappear?
Anonymous is a strange thing. I'm just thinking about the peculiarities of anonymity. Siegfried Gideon has a wonderful chapter on anonymous history in Space, Time, and Architecture, in which he explains that all the things we do absentmindedly, without any special awareness of their full intent, these are the things that create environments that, in effect, are anonymous history of our own inner lives. But just as we record the history of our inner lives on our faces, so corporately we record the history of our lives and our motives in the anonymous objects of the environment. All sorts of humble objects, whether ads or comics, all sorts of things of that type that constitute really the most revealing patterns of our inner lives.
I want to choose arbitrarily in the rather short space of time we have left and ask you a question that really has very little to do with what we've been talking about, but which I find very interesting. You said anybody whose appearance strongly declares his role and status in life is wrong for television. Why is that?
Matching. Not making. The old concept of casting. I'm not adequate here, but the concept of casting in Hollywood necessarily is very different from the concept of casting in TV. And I've noticed myself that one of the effects of TV on me is that as I walk around in the world, I in the ordinary, say at airports or anywhere at all, I'm amazed at the number of people who I instinctively feel would be tremendous TV material. Now, whether these same people would be good movie material, I doubt. A natural movie person has to match some category. He's perfect for this category. I don't think you have to have categories for the TV casting in the same way that you do this simple correspondence of matching, one-to-one matching.
And what was it about these people you saw at airports, for example, that made you think they'd be great for television?
Costume. Role-playing. Today, the airports and our airplanes and our business world, our streets, are full of festive role-playing people in festive mood, going about their everyday lives as if they were medieval characters, with strange and unexpected hairdos and wonderful colors in their clothes and garments and patterns in the same. We hear about the ancient medieval clown wearing his motley, but amazing numbers of people today are dressed in motley.
This is cliché to archetype, is it?
Yes, I suppose you could say there's a retrieval of ancient cliché by means of the new cliché of TV surround. But TV viewers seem to go richly for role-playing and acting and love costumes. Now, here is where the big mini-midi hassle is. The midi is a dress and not a costume. The mini was retrieved from ancient tribal cliché by TV. The midi is not an ancient form of costume. It's dress. It's private.
The midi came out of what? Costume movies?
No. The midi is just an ordinary dress.
I should say the maxi.
The maxi and the mini are costumes from other cultures. All tribal societies wear miniskirts, men and women alike. The Venus de Milo wears a miniskirt. But a miniskirt is a costume and is not a dress. And when you put on a costume of that tribal kind, you put on the power of the whole tribe. The miniskirt is power. The midi is merely a private preference. It's personal and individual. The mini is not personal. It's tribal and corporate and is pure power. And so that's where the hang-up is. If you can talk about hang-up in mini. It's a form of high-rise which has tremendous power behind it. It is high-rise architecture and miniskirts have much in common. Both are returns to the module, the repetitive module. But, yes, the mini and the midi are examples of cliched archetypes that we could spend a long time on.
Professor McLuhan, we have, unfortunately, only 1 minute left.
All right.
You may not think that's so unfortunate, but... Could I ask you, what guidance would you offer ordinary people to find their way through life as it is today in about 30 seconds?
Well, I think we live in one of the richest, in fact, incomparably the richest age of all human history. There is nothing even remotely approaching the riches of human experience and knowledge and the diversity of human condition today. And our access to all times and places and all pasts and presents and all futures contained in the present today. I can't imagine anything more rich or exciting. On the other hand, if you say a guide, surely the guide is simply to use our perceptions to their maximal powers of enjoyment. I suggest that we begin to consider the world as we have now presented it as a spectacle of very rich enjoyment.
Thank you very much, sir. Marshall McLuhan has been speaking freely. Edwin Newman, NBC News.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. For all the news that is news across the non-physical nation, voulez-vous à fumoi? Moi, Marshall on Ion. And you'll have to call Paul Harvey for the rest of the story. Good day.